Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. It is always exciting when we can have a morning show conversation about something that we utterly take for granted or do not stop to really deeply ponder. How about something as pervasive, as ordinary as our names? Why is it that each of us is given a name? Why is it that we have a first and a middle and a last name? Why is it that the tradition emerged for the woman when she marries to take on the name of her husband? Why is it that in certain times in our history or certain places in the world, people were identified by one single name, Aristotle? Where did that tradition come from? There are all kinds of fascinating questions to explore about the whole phenomenon of naming. And it is explored so beautifully in a new book called The Power of Names, Uncovering the Mystery of What We Are Called. The author of the book is Mavis Himes, a PhD psychoanalyst and clinical psychologist based in Toronto. And she has written about this interesting facet of human existence in very intriguing fashion, in part from the perspective of her own Jewish faith. But the book certainly goes beyond that as well, and touches on many, many different traditions and legacies. The book is published by Roman and Littlefield. Again, it's called The Power of Names. And Mavis Himes, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be on the show.
I'm really interested to be talking with you. I think somebody at a glance might be intrigued by the fact that a clinical psychologist is writing such a book. Can you just say a word about how your own professional expertise and field of interest intersects with something like the phenomenon of how we are named?
Certainly. I wear two hats. I wear a clinical psychology hat, and I also wear a hat as a psychoanalyst. And it's really through that door that this book or this topic came to me. You know, we come into this world as no different than animals, in a sense. We could say we're a bundle of biological, you know, nerve endings and anatomical structures. And it's only when we are named, and in fact we are called into being, as I would say, that we become human. And so it's this aspect of being animated and infused with life through our name. We're the only species that names. And it's interesting how when you have a pet, you also name the pet because they become like part of the family and human as well. So there's something about when names don't take, and in my work as a psychoanalyst, I sometimes see cases where the name really becomes a bit of a metaphor for problems, because the name is connected to who we are and to our past, etc. So it's through that, really. Right.
In some ways I have a very unremarkable name, and yet there's something remarkable about it in that my full name is, and probably most listeners to the morning show have no idea, my full name is David Gregory Berg.
Uh-huh.
But my parents, right from the start, called me Greg, and the reason was because they had relatives in Milwaukee with three successive generations of Ronald. And so you had Big Ron and Little Ron and Baby Ron. And even when Baby Ron is a college student, he's still Baby Ron to clarify which Ron are we talking about. And so they didn't want me to be little David.
But they liked
the way David Gregory Berg rolled off the tongue. So that is my full name. And the issue comes up again and again. And it's just kind of fun. In a sense, I appreciate the fact that there's something about my name that's just ever so slightly out of the ordinary. And I think for me, maybe it's made me a little more conscious of my name, or I think about exactly what my name is.
But what's so interesting and what's so typical in what you're saying is that as soon as I would mention this topic to someone, I would get exactly what you've just done. I would get a story about their name, whether they liked their name, they didn't like their name, whether the history of their particular name. And you also bring up a point that many people are named in certain traditions. The same name becomes, you know, Bob Senior, Bob Junior, Bob the First, Bob the Second, within a family, right? That we're named after some people, after family relatives or people, you know, within one family. In my tradition in Judaism, one can't name someone after a living member, and so you would only be named after someone who's deceased. And in that case, often it would be the second name, the middle name you'd be given of that relative. So it really varies with different cultures, the whole naming choice.
Right. I appreciate that your book, among other things, helps us to kind of delineate the nature of one's first name and one's last name.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That in a sense, one of them is one kind of statement, and the other is a very different statement about, in a sense, who we are and where we fit in the world and fit within our own family trees. Just say
very,
a word about that difference.
So. Mm-hmm. Yes, very much so. Because the first name is really the, it satisfies a lot of the desires, expectations, fantasies of what a parent has for their child. So whether it's, I want my child to be so intelligent and named after a famous author, scientist, philosopher, or I want my daughter to be, you know, as beautiful as Elizabeth Taylor or Marilyn Monroe, and so I name her Elizabeth or Marilyn. And parents, I'm sure everyone listening realizes the amount of time and energy that goes into naming a child. And someone recently said to me, boy, it was such a huge responsibility. I was thinking, this little person that I'm bringing into the world is going to have to live with this name. So it's got to be, you know, a name that's so important. So that's the first name. And the second name is really carries our legacy. You know, it's our connection to our ancestors, to our lineage. And it's not a choice. We say the first name is a given. It's a donato. It's a gift. And the second name, the surname, is really, you know, carrying the lineage, as I say. And they each have different kind of psychological valence, really. Mm-hmm.
I like that. You also mention in the prologue something that I think is so important for framing this conversation. You write, most of us take our names for granted, yet our first name, both an introduction and a greeting, is one of the first words we learned. Assigned to us by our parents with love, it is freighted with their expectations and hopes for our future. Our surname, meanwhile, carries our collective history. It is a branding of transmission and affiliation, linking us to our ancestral past. But I love that fact that our first name is one of the first words any of us ever hear. And so in that respect, it is so integral to who we are from the first moment we're outside the womb.
And you bring a very important point by mentioning that, because the first name is given to us. And it's not strongly pronounced in the book, but there is a theme that I feel is important, which is that the name is a house in in which we live, but it's a word that's given to us. It comes from outside of us. And somewhere along the way, through life, our life journey, we have to appropriate that name and make it our home, from a house to a home, to something we inhabit, and that becomes our unique identity. Not only the expectations and fantasies of our parents, what they would like us to be, and not only the traditions of our ancestors, but somehow that we create out of our name. It's a kind of metaphor for who we are, in a sense. So I think that's really important.
I love that. And in the first chapter, which is called An Invitation into Being, I love the, in some ways it's maybe the slightest bit of a tangent, but I don't mean that at all critically. I love the moment you take to talk about an infant and hearing the sound of his or her mother's voice. Mm-hmm. And you write this: soon the infant will scan the musical notes of his mother's voice. These sounds will no longer be only a source of comfort or of emptiness, but also of information and signification. And very quickly, he will recognize those particular and distinctive sounds that form smoothly into a regular sequence. The labels that he hears and to which he responds become repetitive language patterns. And with increasing familiarity, he hears his own name as a melody of sweetness, or at times bitterness, to which he orients himself without hesitation. Conversely, the infant will also discover the power of his own sound. Within weeks, he will begin to recognize the impact of his own voice, his own cries, on the person who hears the cries as a call. The mother, interpreting the sounds of her infant as a demand for food, for comfort, for warmth, responds in haste, in panic, or in time, gradually attributing particular meanings to her baby's sounds. In this way, our little newborn will become a speaking being, a parletre, who will enter the world of desire and determination, drive and enthusiasm. His life will be honored and commemorated, lived with his named presence until its end.
Did I write that?
You did, and beautifully. And but I also love the way in which we think about how our name and our voice are, in a sense, intertwined, and it's difficult to think about one without the other.
Right, and think of how our name is pronounced in different situations. So you've got the voice and intonation of someone who's your partner, your life partner, your husband, your wife, your girlfriend, boyfriend, and how the melody and how those special terms of affection and how they pronounce our voice, as opposed to someone who's a stranger. And I think somewhere in there I indicate that sometimes in conversation, when people use our name over and over, and I gave the example of a car salesman, there's a kind of transgression for me, an overstepping of boundaries, because there's a familiarity in using our first name. We don't automatically use someone's first name. We often, you know, if it's a doctor, or it's a peer, it's okay. But a stranger who says, oh, Mavis, do you like this? Mavis, do you like that? Mavis, do you want? It feels like they're overstepping a boundary there.
Right.
That we don't have that relationship familiarity, and I don't want you assuming that you know me that intimately that you can automatically use my name repeatedly like that.
Right. You talk about the discomfort of a transgression, a line crossed without permission. To use someone's first name in casual conversation is to assume a particular relationship to that person.
That's
we
right.
do not enter such intimacy without implicit permission, nor are we always prepared to grant this privilege to others. Sometimes the familiar use of our name becomes a trespassing of boundaries. And of course, it's important then to understand, not just thinking about that particular transgression or offense, but just the fact that that says a lot about what our name is, and what our name creates for us.
That's right. That's right. It's interesting. It just made me, it's a bit tangential here, but, you know, in French or in Spanish, other languages, we have the two forms of addressing the you. You know, the familiar and the formal. So it's kind of using, in some cases, it's a parallel to using that very intimate, informal use of the t form instead of the vu, and we usually ask permission. Mm. So I have patients who will say to me, can I call you Mavis, or are you Dr. Hines?
Mm.
You know, because one can't assume that relationship.
Absolutely.
Automatically.
We're speaking with Mavis Hines, who is the author of a new book called The Power of Names, Uncovering the Mystery of What We Are Called. I wonder if you could say a word about your own Jewish heritage, Jewish background, which, of course, is a very rich ground from which to draw when it comes to the matter of naming. And, I mean, I happen to be Lutheran, so a lot of what you write about in this book are quite unfamiliar concepts, although some of them are. Mm-hmm. Some of them we share. But I found some of this to be particularly fascinating, the importance of naming within the Jewish tradition. And at one point in the book, you even trace some of that importance back to the whole notion of a wandering people, a nomadic people.
Right, right. So that's a huge question, and I'm going to try and break it down into a few pieces. So my name, which you referred to as Mavis Hines, is the other piece of the impetus for this book, because it started with a certain awareness and working my own personal work on myself and who I am. And my father, who was Jewish, as you mentioned, and was one of nine siblings, seven of which were boys, decided at some point to change their name. The name was Haimovich. So that's a very Jewish-sounding name, and growing up in Montreal, after the war in the 40s, he and his siblings decided to anglicize, shorten the name to make it to fit in more and not to be, draw attention to it. This is a very, very common experience, not only among Jewish people, but all many, many ethnic people who move to a new country and who want to eliminate the foreign-sounding, the ethnic-sounding part of their name. And there are studies even today that show that if you look at a list of people for job applicants or university applicants, in spite of thinking how pluralistic and liberal we are, those foreign-sounding names are less, you know, have less chance of being accepted to the university or the job. So there's still that kind of prejudice when you hear a foreign-sounding name. Mm. So to get back to my story, so my surname was Haimovich. My first name, Mavis, was, I was named after my great aunt, my grandmother's sister, whose name was Malka, which is a Hebrew name. And often in the Jewish faith, we name, as I said, a child after a relative who's died. And because we don't necessarily keep the Hebrew name, because we have a Hebrew name and a secular name, we often name it after the first letter, so M, common to Malka, common to Mavis. But my Hebrew name is still Malka. And that Hebrew name is used in Jewish ceremony, weddings, burials, anything to do with the Jewish faith, any rituals, I would be called by my Hebrew name. My name conceals. It doesn't reveal. When people meet me, Mavis Hines, they have no idea what my ethnic background is. If I met you and I said, my name is Malka Haimovich, that has a completely different resonance. You would know immediately what my background was. So that's why I say the name announces. And through that, people often expect certain things. You know, you meet someone with the name Annie Wong, you expect to meet an Oriental person, and yet this could be the surname of her partner or husband. And so we have preconceived notions just based on the sound of the name.
You know, it's so interesting as you kind of talk about the way in which many names are changed, and often people coming to this country might change their names ever so slightly, and sometimes change those names quite dramatically.
Exactly.
And in many, many cases, there is no way to know exactly what was going through their minds. Was the name changed out of fear, or was the name changed out of a sense of ambition, or some kind of strange mix of those feelings and maybe others? I'd never stopped to think about how a real veil, a really impenetrable veil of mystery, probably surrounds that. Maybe most of the time, probably most of the time, we don't know the answer to that question.
Yes, and many names go through transformations. And in your introduction, you mentioned the point that, you know, the Greeks had mononyms. They had one name, and it would be, Aristotle the something or other, or so-and-so the Stoic, or so-and-so the, and it could be a place name, a city name. And then the Romans had three names. But the Western world was mainly mononyms also. It was your first name, and those names typically were biblical names or names that had some relationship to a characteristic. They don't translate well in English. Joy, let's say. So may she bring joy, or faith. Names that had a meaning, right? And then it was only in the 1700s when the pool of first names grew too big, and for taxation purposes, for civil purposes, the government needed to increase the pool of names, and surnames were added. And those who didn't own property, like the gypsies, the Jews, the disenfranchised, didn't have a surname until much later. That came much later. So, and many people, as you say, with these different surnames, want to fit into whatever community they belong in.
Right.
So there's a long history of name changing.
Absolutely.
Name changing, as you say, to hide one's ethnic identity, but also many actors, many, artists, many change their name.
Right.
To sound more sexy.
Yeah. And I happen to be a music professor in my other life, a voice teacher with a background in opera. And one of the most intriguing reasons for an opera singer to change their name, once upon a time, I don't think it happens nowadays very often at all, but once upon a time, there would be American singers who would change their name into something that appeared to be Italian. So a soprano named Margaret Roberts would change her name to Margheriti Roberti.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, exactly.
And right. I think nowadays it doesn't happen because, generally speaking at least, American opera singers are among the best trained in the world. And so, you're proud to be American in that respect at least. And that the last thing you would do is change your name to appear not American.
But it's a fascinating phenomenon. Right. And names go through phases, right? We also see that, especially first names, they go in popularity. So the 60s had a lot of hippie names like Dawn and Aurora or, Moonshine or, and then there are trends that, different trends. I'm not sure where we're at now, but I think people now want to search still for unusual sounding names.
Right.
The time when the pool was Linda, Susan, Barbara, Anne,
I am particularly fascinated by the phenomenon in modern America, in at least certain sectors of the African American community, where in many respects names are created that, at least as far as the parents are concerned, are utterly unique, and that is why they are created. I mean, specifically, so this is a name that no one else has ever had. Lequestrian, or whatever it might be.
Right.
And the more exotic sounding, the better. And I really wonder, and I imagine you wonder too, what is sort of the emotional or psychological hunger that is being satisfied?
Right. What immediately pops in my mind is perhaps the desire to be particularly unique as the name, and yet exotic as well, to kind of carry one's heritage in a prideful way, because if it's African Americans, there are people who've had a long history of, slavery and disempowerment. So a kind of pride and saying, look, this is who I am, And at the same time, a uniqueness that, but pride comes to mind as well, you know, very much. That's off the top of my head. That's what I think of.
Right. Mm-hmm. Part two of your book is titled Burden or Blessing. And of course, it talks about the fact that we feel, as you write at one point, an obligation to live up to our name, be it a name of fame or obscurity. For better or worse, we are all subjects of identification. And so, you know, whatever your, you know, if your last name happens to be Einstein, or if your last name happens to be Hitler, or whatever it might be, but there is this sense that we can be blessed by our name and we can be burdened by our name.
Right.
That's an intriguing concept.
Yes, and I think the burden part can be at what I would call a psychosocial level, like to carry a name like Hitler. I just read the biography of Stalin's daughter, written by a Canadian, and the struggle she had with her name, and at some point she marries and she moves to America and changes her name to Lana Peters. Svetlana was her first name, so it's taking the last few letters. And Peters was, Wes Peters was one of her many husbands. So the burden of that weighed at a kind of psychosocial level. But there's also the kind of deeper inner psychological burden of carrying a name that may have been fraught with abuse in one's family, a kind of need to distance oneself from some horrendous psychological abuse, if you want. And so that burden and the need to perhaps be identical, you know, if you carry a Kennedy name or a Rockefeller, there's a whole prescription of how you should behave, as you mentioned. But I think psychologically it also can be that kind of inner burden to want to create and fashion your own identity that's not so linked with that name that carries such a weight.
Hmm. I want to mention that there's also a chapter in the book quite interesting called In the Name of the Father, in which you talk about the matter that is so pervasive of the male name sort of carrying the weight. And of course, we live in an age now where women are not nearly so prone to do that. Or I think of my own sister, who she and her husband, all through their wedding, I mean, during the ceremony, were still quietly whispering to each other about what their married name should be. And it was only towards the very end, before my father, who officiated, was finally told by one of them that we want our last name to be Spencer Berg, hyphenated.
Right.
But, I mean, right to the last possible moment, they were debating amongst themselves, which should it be? Should we hold our own, or what should we do? But
exactly.
Says something about how
huge. It's a very, very, today, you know, or for the last, you know, since the women's movement, I think that's been a huge issue. And that chapter you mentioned in The Name of the Father is probably the most psychological chapter for me, and has some, you know, interesting concepts in it. But so again, I think there's always the question, who is the father? You know, we know the mother. We know the mother's carrying the baby in her belly. There's no question about who's the mother is. But there's always this deep-seated, unconscious question of who the father is, right? We never know. It's on faith that you think you know who the father is.
Or the result of a blood test that you would know,
right,
but there
right,
is no
right,
immediate
exactly.
visible way to know, oh, yes, this must be the father here.
Right.
Yes.
And even though we know, I mean, women know who the husband is most of the time, there's still this kind of lingering in one's unconscious, that doubt. And so that anecdote that I mentioned in the book where the husband says, or people say, oh, yeah, he's got, you know, daddy's eyes or daddy's nose, it's almost a sigh of relief. Yes, this really is my child. You know, thank God.
Absolutely. Right. And there's so much to think about in the naming that we do in our lives. And my closing thought is my cousins from northern Minnesota, who all have two middle names. And just this morning, I wrote one of them. I said, how come all of you have two middle names instead of just one? And I'm expecting to hear that it's Episcopalian or it's some other, you know, ethnic reason. No, it was that the mom and dad argued about who the oldest child's middle name should be, so they just put them both down, and then they liked the way that sort of rolled out. So now they all have two middle names and beautiful names that they cherish, and it just all that your book, it just sort of spurs us on to think about our names and the importance of naming.
I'm so delighted that you were so taken with the book. That's very comforting and very reassuring.
It's a fascinating book. Again, it's called The Power of Names, Uncovering the Mystery of What We Are Called, published by Roman and Littlefield, and the author, Mavis Himes. Mavis Himes, thank you so much for writing such a fascinating book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. I've really enjoyed this.
Thank you so much for having me on your show. Take care.